Like I said, we're going to continue with Matthew chapter 24. The reason we're discussing Matthew chapter 24 is we're about to come up on it in our Bible study. This is one of those passages that, especially today in the world, and even among our own brethren, there is some misguided teachings about this passage. I don't know how many of you are familiar with what's called the AD 70 doctrine, but it comes from Matthew 24. In AD 70, the Roman general Titus destroyed the temple and the city of Jerusalem. At that point, most historians and geologists or whatever feel like that the articles of the tabernacle, the articles of the temple rather, the Ark of the Covenant and all the gold and everything, was taken by him when he was recalled back to Rome, and then it was used to help fund the building of Rome. We don't know for sure. But the point is that a lot of people take the text of Matthew chapter 24 and in the AD 70 doctrine say that Jesus has already come and that that was his second coming. I got a simple question. Why are we still worshiping and why are we still observing the Lord's Supper until he comes if he's already returned? It is a difficult passage, and it's more difficult when I want to see things in there that are not there. In our last lesson last week, we covered the first half of Matthew chapter 24. And this is oftentimes called the Olivet Discourse because, as the first few verses talk about, Jesus has come out of the temple and he's on Mount Olive talking to his disciples. It is a challenging passage, as I've already said. It's difficult, and I think most of the times passages are difficult because we make them difficult. If we read it for simply what it says, I don't think it would be as difficult as people in the world and in the church want to talk about. It is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 by Titus the Roman general. It seems like it's talking about the second coming of Christ. Or maybe it's both. Well, that's what we're going to discuss today. I have suggested that the whole chapter is talking simply about the destruction of Jerusalem and not the second coming of Christ. And we'll talk about that as we go through. But it begins by looking at the words of Jesus in the temple in the first few verses of Matthew 24. He talks about the prophecy concerning the temple at this time. And then his disciples ask a couple of questions. They want to know, when will these things be? And then they ask a second question that's also recorded in Mark and Luke, of what will be the sign of these things to be fulfilled? When these things happen, what do we need to look for? Well, you know, people look at this passage and in times past they say, oh, well, it's pointing toward the Armageddon. It's pointing toward the final battle between God and Jesus and the devil. And they say, well, that's what it's going to be. How many times have you heard people, mankind throughout history, talk about the Battle of Armageddon is about to take place? I remember when George H.W. Bush went into the Iraqi theater. I don't know if you remember or not, but people were saying, oh, this is Armageddon. Armageddon referring to the ending battle of all times, of all things, and they're saying that's what we're going into. 20-something years later, and we're still here. The Battle of Armageddon, as man said, did not take place. How many times throughout our history has man says, well, we've done the math? I remember August the 8th of 1988. Somebody saying, that's it. That's going to be the end of time. I remember Y2K, when everything was supposed to shut down and everybody started hoarding water and peanut butter and all this stuff in their closets and buying guns and ammunition because that's going to be the end of time. We're still here. You know why? Because man doesn't know when God's going to send Christ back. Christ doesn't even know. So how can we say, well, now Jesus talks about His second coming in Matthew 24, and it's already happened. How many people throughout our history have died thinking that, well, I'm just going to go ahead and take care of it because He's coming? Didn't Paul condemn the Thessalonians for selling everything that they had and sitting down and basically waiting because they believed Christ was going to return? Nobody knows. And we'll point out that Peter says He's going to return like a thief in the night. You don't know when your house is going to be robbed, do you? If you did, you'd be making preparations. But the disciples asked these questions. And we see that question, those questions, in Matthew's account in chapter 24 and verse 3, Mark 13 and verse 4, Luke 21 and verse 7. Now what we saw in the lesson last week in the first half of Matthew, verses 4 through 29, was Jesus describing what will not be the sign other than the gospel being preached to all nations, verses 4 through 14. But then He talked about what will be the sign in verse 24 and verse 15. He says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, and He says, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Well, Daniel says in Daniel 9, beginning in verse 26, and after 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself, and for the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood, to the end of the war. End of the war of desolations are determined. Then He shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week He shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. So He says here the abomination of desolation that was spoken of by Daniel in chapter 9. And Luke explains it in his own words in Luke 21 and verse 20. He quotes Jesus and He says, this is when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Now, did the second coming of Christ come when Rome surrounded Jerusalem? No. No, the destruction of Jerusalem happened then. And Jesus warned the Christians that when you see this, you need to flee. So what do they do when they see the sign is what they want to know. What are we supposed to do when we see this sign? Matthew 24, verses 16 through 28, Jesus talks about this. Those who were in Judea were to flee to the mountains to avoid this great tribulation. And they were not to be misled by anybody claiming to be Christ or false prophets. So Jesus warns them that when this takes place, there's going to be some that step up to claim to be the Messiah. Jesus says, don't believe them. There's going to be some that step up to be prophets of God. He said, don't believe them. You do what I'm telling you to do. When you see this army surrounding Judea and Jerusalem, you flee to the mountains. We pointed out last week that Eusebius pointed out in his history that when Jerusalem was destroyed, there were millions of Jews that were killed or taken hostage, but there were not one Christian who suffered because they believed Jesus. They listened to Him. So up to verse 29 now, Jesus described a local event. It's a judgment that you cannot escape from that's about to fall upon Jerusalem. He does not describe a worldwide cataclysmic event. That would be something that you can't get away from. And He just told them, says, when you see this happening, run. When Jesus comes back, how are you going to run? How can you flee? Would it do any good? Because in other places he says, the Bible teaches us that when he returns, the dead are going to come up out of the graves. The sea will give up their dead. How can you run from that type of judgment? But with verse 29, some believe that Jesus is addressing his return. There are some commentaries that address that. J.W. McGarvey in his Fourfold Gospel considers this Jesus' second return. But as we continue with our study, I want to suggest to you that Jesus is still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So as we continue this Olivet discussion or discourse, we're going to see what's going to happen next. Events, he says, are going to occur. But he says that they are immediate after the tribulation of those days. So again, the question begs to be asked. If Jesus has returned, why are we still observing this memorial feast until his return? And I've got family members that believe in the AD 70 doctrine that Jesus came when Titus destroyed Jerusalem. And he will argue with you till the sun goes down that he is right. But he's wrong. He's misled. He has believed false Christ and false prophets. Jesus said these events are going to take place immediately. He says in Matthew 24 and verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the earth, of heavens will be shaken. So notice he says here, the sun's going to be darkened immediately after that. He says the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And he says in verse 30, then, that the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with power and great glory. So this is where they get this misconception that Jesus has already returned. But he says the elect in verse 31. He says he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. You see, the problem with this language here is that Jesus, or rather God's word, has used this particular language before to describe earthly events. The events were to occur immediately. And it certainly sounds like what Jesus said, or what the apostles were told when Jesus ascended, that this is how he's going to come back. But there's two reasons why this is not the return of Christ. It says the events would take place immediately in those days, after the tribulation of those days, verse 29 and Mark 13 and verse 24. They are connected to the tribulation that's described in verses 15 through 28 of our text. This coming of Jesus was to occur at the conclusion of the siege of Jerusalem. These events are similar to God foretelling judgment about other nations throughout the Bible. We look at these condemnations of other nations. Babylon. That's what's said of Babylon in Isaiah chapter 13, verses 1 through 13. It is said about Egypt in Isaiah chapter 19. It is said about the city of Tyre in Isaiah 23. It is said about the nation of Edom in Isaiah 34. It is said about the city of Nineveh in Nahum 1. Israel. It's said of Israel way back in Amos. Amos chapter 8. And it is said about the nation of Judah in Jeremiah chapter 4. Now it's for these reasons that I suggest that even in Matthew 24, verses 29 through 31, that Jesus is still not talking about the end of time, but he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Beginning in verse 29, he says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened. We've already noticed this passage. And the moon will not give its light, the stars will have fallen from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the others. Jesus here is still speaking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Just like other Jewish prophets, Jesus uses figurative language to describe this judgment. The fall of the wicked in terms of a worldwide destruction. The provision that's made for the righteous in terms of the gathering being done by angels. Jewish prophets of old would foretell of God's destruction and His judgment upon different nations. We've already pointed those out, from Babylon to Judah. And they used figures of worldwide destruction, even though the destruction was always limited to a local event. Maybe because such judgments would foreshadow God's final judgment in what was to come at the end of the time, at the end of the world, the entire world, in the last day. Well, the rest of the chapter includes warnings or admonitions that they were to be prepared and be productive. Unlike the Thessalonian Christians, they were trying to prepare but not be productive. They wanted to sell everything and sit down and wait on Jesus to come back. And we can't do that. We can't do that. In fact, what we're to do right now is to try to make more disciples in view of the fact that Jesus is going to return. Jesus, in this context, gives the parable in talking about being prepared and productive about the fig tree. In verses 32 and 33, he talked about that there were new branches and leaves that indicated summer was near. It was time for this fig tree to be productive and producing figs, producing fruit. And he says, when you see these things, the time is near. Jerusalem, that is, being surrounded by armies. He said, when you see that happening, the time is near. He says, it's going to happen before this generation passed away. Notice verse 34 if you have your Bibles open. It's all going to happen before this generation passes away. Now, if that's the case, some of you are pretty old. I mean, really old. Not that old. I mean, you'd have to be 2,000 years old. And still hoping that it's not happened yet. You hear records being broken here lately of people being 100 and plus years old, but that's nowhere near 2,000. And Jesus says, some of you are going to see this happening. Well, how can it have already happened if you haven't seen it? You see, Jesus said, it's going to happen in this generation. So how is he talking about the end of time if you haven't seen anything? Some define this generation as a race of people. In other words, the Jews, according to McGarvey and Johnson in their commentaries. But we need to note that this was used by Jesus just before this discussion in Matthew chapter 23, as we're discussing on Sunday mornings now in our Bible class with the seven woes of warnings. But especially in verse 36. Now this is before the discussion about the destruction. He says, assuredly I say to you, all these things will happen or will come upon this generation. Now, which generation is he talking about? The generation that you're living in now, or the generation that was there in his presence listening to him? I believe we know the answer to that, don't we? The generation was the people that he was speaking to. He said that heaven and earth are going to pass away in one day. That's what Peter tells us. By the way, that destruction of Jerusalem happened within 40 years after Jesus said this. So definitely some of that generation would see it. Marilyn and I were sitting and talking last night, or maybe yesterday afternoon, sometime, I forget, but we had a conversation about if we had lived 100 years ago and we're living now, would you believe some of the changes that have happened in our world? 100 years ago, maybe taking a phone and cranking it and calling a switchboard operator or somebody down at the general store and say, can you connect me? And now you pull a phone out of your pocket. It's got a phone, a camera, a computer, almost a supercomputer, that could connect you with anybody throughout the world. Can you imagine the changes that have been made? This happened within 40 years of Jesus speaking about it. 40 years. The words of Jesus are going to come to pass. Be productive. Be prepared. Verse 35 of our text in Matthew 24 says that the words of Jesus will come to pass. Heaven and earth are going to pass away within a day, Peter says. In Matthew, in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, he says, but the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. By the way, if Jesus returned at the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, why did the apostles keep writing epistles and letters? Why, if it happened, did Peter say that it's being preserved by the same word and reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men? In verse 10, he says, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. You still don't know when he's coming back. And yet, some of our own brethren say, well, he's done been here. How do we miss him? He says, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. When did God destroy the earth and we missed it? You know, there are some religions that teach that only 144,000 are going to go to heaven and God's going to remodel the earth, refashion it, and make it into a paradise. And those that didn't make it are going to get to live on. Is this paradise? Is this paradise that we're living in now with all the moral corruption that we see around us? If it's paradise, why are we still having wars and rumors of wars? Our president's sending 3,000, I think, men and women over to Ukraine right now. If that's happening, why is it happening if we're in paradise? Because Peter says it hadn't happened yet. The words that Jesus spoke will by no means pass away, verse 35. And yet some believe that Jesus is now talking about his second coming. But Jesus is using an illustration to prove his point, the surety of his very words, like in Matthew 5 and verse 18. He tells us that of that day and time, only the Father knows, verse 36. So in this very context, if they want to say he's already returned, Jesus said nobody knows. Only the Father knows when that day will be. They might discuss or decide the general timing with the advance of armies toward Jerusalem. But the hour and the day and the time of the Roman siege, it would begin when God was ready for it to begin. God knew. He says, so don't delay when you see the sign appear. That sign was going to be Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. He tells them in verses 37 through 39, it's going to be like in the days of Noah, in the days before the flood. Noah knew what was coming. And he was preparing. He was being productive. He kept preaching. And yet people kept about their normal activities. And only when it was too late did the people really know what was happening. Before the siege of Jerusalem, Jesus talks here that people are going to go about their daily routine. Many people probably thought that this conflict was going to end peacefully. And they were going to get to live out their lives the same way. But once the siege, the attack began, it's too late. He said in verses 40 and 41 that some will be taken away. That's the siege. Some are going to be taken away. But you have to remember what Eusebius told us, or Flavius Josephus also told us in his book, The Jewish Wars, that 97,000 Jews were taken captive. Some were killed by beast in Rome, and some were sent to Egypt as slaves. When the siege took place, it was too late. So he tells them in verses 42 and 44 to watch. Watch for these things to happen and then flee. You don't know the hour of the time of the Son of Man's return. He says, so don't be caught off guard. It's just like we've talked about. You can't sit down like the Thessalonians and say, well, I know he's going to return, so I'm going to sell everything I've got and just sit here and wait. Can't do that. Paul condemned them. He rebuked them. He says, you've got to continue to live. Don't be caught off guard like the master of the house who didn't know that the thief could break in. Be ready, Jesus says, because the Son of Man will come when you are not expecting him. The siege in Jerusalem, he says, might begin promptly. He says, so when you see it happening, when you see the approach of the Roman army, he tells them to flee Judah quickly. When you see the armies beginning to surround Jerusalem, you better run. He warned them, said, don't even take time to go back to the house and get a change of clothes. You run now. Not a Christian was taken hostage or killed in the Roman siege because they listened to Jesus. The parable of the faithful servant and the wicked servant, Matthew 24, verses 45 through 51, talks about this. The faithful servant is blessed because he did the master's will when he came, knew that he was coming. So the disciples of Jesus were admonished or warned, encouraged to be prepared, but to be productive. Now, as we close out this lesson, there's a lot that alludes to Jesus' second coming, the last day. But that is no different than the prophecies of old by other Jewish prophets that foretold of God's judgment upon other nations that we noticed, from Babylon to Nineveh to Jerusalem and Judah itself. It was a common motive, if you will, used by Jewish prophets. And what they were doing was trying to teach the Israelites, the Jews, to not be caught by surprise. And here Jesus uses the same thing. And rightly so, because God's judgment upon other nations in the past are types and shadows, if you will, of the final judgment. The fall of the entire world when Jesus does come again. Now, in addition to the setting leading up to the discourse, there is a natural flow in this discussion of the discourse itself that leads me to conclude entirely that this is talking only about the destruction of Jerusalem. Verses 1 through 14, what will not be the sign? Remember, the disciples there are told by Jesus what will not be the sign. And he tells them what to look for when his coming is near. Verse 15, And they are told what to do when they see this sign, verses 16 through 28. And his coming in judgment, that is the fall of Jerusalem, the judgment upon Jerusalem, is described in terms that remind us and other Jewish people about what God, or the prophets of God, how they would foretell of God's judgment upon other nations in their past. Verses 29 through 31. And they're warned, be prepared. They are warned here. This is given for them to be productive, be prepared, while they know that this is going to come in their lifetime, in this generation. Verses 32 through 51. So me, personally, I view this Olivet discourse or discussion to describe a local event that they can't escape from, which occurred as Jesus foretold in AD 70, that they could get away from, and that generation is going to happen. However, there is still the worldwide judgment that you cannot escape from, that's coming in the last day. Paul, in warning those Thessalonian Christians about this, talked about that last day in 1 Thessalonians 5, 2 Thessalonians 1, and we've already discussed 2 Peter 3. So my question for you is, the destruction of Jerusalem's already happened. You can't do anything about that. But you can rest assured that Christ is coming back. He's promised. Part of that promise is no one knows when he's coming back except God Almighty. The question is, are you ready for when he does return? The admonitions to be prepared and be productive are very similar. We go back to what Peter says in 2 Peter 3, beginning in verse 10. He says, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. If you knew the thief was coming, you'd make preparations, wouldn't you? In which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, notice, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? How should you be living your life right now, knowing that this day could happen at any time? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. If you know it's going to happen, why aren't you ready? It's just like tax day. You know it's going to happen every year, right, Jason? When I went to my tax guy, he helps preachers do their taxes. He told me, he says, now, are you ready? He said, because this year is going to hit you hard, not having been self-employed before. Are you ready? Have you been putting money back? I said, yeah, I am ready. He said, well, how ready are you? And he asked how much I'd put back. He said, oh, you'll be fine. He said, but do you know how many young men go into preaching and they're not ready? They don't make preparations. They're not being prepared, knowing that day is coming. It's going to come like clockwork. And he said, but they're not ready. And eventually they have to go get a secular job to pay and dig themselves out of taxes where they were not able to pay them. You know it's coming. You've been prepared. You've told to be productive. Jesus said the day is coming. Peter says the day is coming, looking for and hastening the coming day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Are you ready for that day? It's coming. It's coming whether you're ready or not. But you've had ample warning. You've had all the warning since Jesus made this discussion 40 years before the destruction of Jerusalem, some 2,000 years ago, and still you're told he's coming back. When he ascended on high, in Acts chapter 1, the angel told the apostles, In the same manner that you see him leaving, he's going to return. You can't run. You cannot escape that return. So we have to be prepared, and we have to be productive leading up to that time. Now, if you're here and you've never put Christ on in baptism, you need to be productive. You need to be preparing yourself for that time. You don't know when he's coming back. But if you're here and you have put on Christ in baptism, in making that preparation, if you have something in your life, let's just be blunt, if you've got sin in your life, you need to repent. You need to confess that sin as public as it is, because sin separates us from God. And if you're in a state right now where you are separated from God, you're lost. And when he returns, you'll still be lost. But you have time to prepare and be productive right now. If you're here this morning and subject to the Lord's invitation, I'd encourage you to make your way to the front.